Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, funnily enough, Polling Matters is 2 years old today. It's our birthday. And in that time, we've seen a surprise Conservative win in 2015, led by a man that was barely Prime Minister a year after that. Jeremy Corbyn's been elected leader of the Labour Party twice. Britain has voted to leave the European Union, and Donald Trump has been elected as President of the United States. So I can't promise the next 2 years is going to be as exciting or terrifying as that, depending on your perspective, but we'll be here for the next 2 years, following and beyond, hopefully, following what's going on in the world of politics in the UK and beyond. And here's to that next 2 years. Now, today we're going to be continuing our US election debrief, but we also may find some time to talk about Paul Nuttall's election as UKIP leader later on. So let's get cracking. I'm joined by fellow podcaster Rob Vance as ever. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Lovely to be here.
And also in person by Margie O'Meara, who is a Democratic pollster, Executive Vice President at Public Affairs at Penshone and Berland, and one half of the US-based polling podcast, The Pollsters. Now, regular listeners will know that Margie has joined us back in the primary season of the US 2016 race, but I think it's fair to say a lot's happened since then. So Margie, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's so good to meet in person, and we have always been very careful to say we're the only podcast devoted to public opinion in the US. Yeah. Because of you guys.
It's very kind of you. Let's crack on. I mean, there's so much potentially to cover in the US race, and it's hard to imagine that it's only, 3 weeks or less than that since the vote, Margie. But what was your perspective, I guess, as you look back in the last fortnight or so at the results? What are your impressions of the result? What drove it? What do you think?
So let me just give you a little context of what it was like being a Democratic operative and someone who talks about polls the week of the election. So election night, we had all of our friends from the neighborhood. I live in a very, very liberal, one of the most liberal neighborhoods in the country. And so we had all our friends from the neighborhood, all their kids, all their young daughters sitting on the couch, staring at the TV, and we're taking pictures so we could record the moment when young 5 to 8 year old girls are watching a woman make history. And then slowly over the course of the night, the kids start to cry, families start to go home, nobody's talking anymore. And it was a pretty miserable time. I had to travel across the country and have meetings the next day, and people did not want to talk about the election. And then I left the country. I mean, I had to really detox physically and mentally in order to be able to handle it. It was that devastating. I mean, people were, the folks on the left were really deeply, truly in mourning and just trying to practice self-care. And for a lot of people, that meant actually not speaking to anyone about politics at all, not going home for Thanksgiving, not going on social media, not reading the news. It was that serious. And I know that there was a similar viewpoint here after Brexit, that people, just wanted to go home and wanted to work. But you have kids feeling, being asked at school by other kids, are you going to be deported now? Why are you still in school? I mean, it's been, you have people using racist language out in the street, on planes with strangers. It's a pretty, pretty tough time. So that's the pushback, right? I think we need to really do more than just grieve, although it's okay to do that. But the thought is, we need to think about what happened, why did this happen? And then also go into, why were we surprised by what happened? That's the polling matter piece of the question, right? And so I don't want to talk too much. I'll answer first the first bucket, and then we can talk about the second one. I mean, what happened is, at some level, if you had no data, no polling at all, you could almost think that it would play out the way it did, almost without the benefit of data. You would have a woman who was, while historic, still was very much part of the establishment. There's no denying that. That's the downside of being supremely qualified, is she earns those qualifications for being part of the establishment at a time when people feel a lot of insecurity. While the economy has rebounded from 2008, from the recession, doesn't mean that people feel like everything is hunky-dory. People feel still very worried that there's instability in our government, in our economy, in our ability to leave a better world for our children, to have children who are going to do better than we do. So that's one foundation. You have Trump really, very much epitomizes the opposite of that. He's about change. He's about literally about blowing up government, almost literally. Just share, a hair shy of literally blowing it up. I mean, the in terms of the kinds of people he's brought in, in terms of the way he uses the media, and in terms of how he talks about government, his lack of knowledge about government, his unwillingness to be introspective or to study up or cram before a debate or a big meeting with ed board, with editorial board. So he's the complete opposite of qualified. And people found that refreshing. And you add on top of all that this layer of racial animosity, which doesn't completely explain Trump. I don't want to say that that's all that this race was about, but it is a part of what it's about. And that also, I think, is really where a lot of the hurt comes from for Democrats, is from that piece of it.
Because people said after the last election when Romney lost that basically the Republicans couldn't win again if they weren't more appealing to minorities.
Right.
And there was some evidence that Trump was maybe more appealing among Hispanics than Romney was, or that's debated. But it does seem like you can still win in America with white voters.
Yeah, I mean, that's really incredible, right? Republicans said, well, no one will ever try this again. And which is to say, to try and run up the score, I'd be a Republican candidate and run up the score with white voters. And in fact, Trump did that and won. And while he did a little bit better than Romney with Latinos, and African-Americans didn't turn out at quite the same rates as before, and slightly less. And Latinos, while there was an increase in the percentage of the electorate, it wasn't massive. It was just, it was a continued uptick, as we've seen over past elections. But Trump's gain was not from not doing well with people of color, but because he did just so massively well with white downscale men, white men, white voters. And he didn't do as poorly with white college-educated women as people, I think, had expected, as a lot of polls led us all to believe. There were some polls that had him down 30 points with that group. And if that had been true on Election Day, we'd be talking about President Clinton, and we wouldn't, have all these questions about the polls. So there is that there's that element of running up the score with white voters, and also Republicans coming home to Trump over the last few weeks. More late deciders breaking to Trump, whether they decide in September or October, when in October. That whole group of voters who decided over the last few weeks, they all broke to Trump, and that's a lot of Republicans saying, I guess I'm voting for Trump. He's the Republican nominee. I guess I'm voting for Trump.
And to what extent is this a failure of the Democrats and Hillary Clinton being the candidate, being the nominee herself as well? Because, she talked a lot about breaking that final glass ceiling, if you like. And, if Trump talks about playing the woman card, then deal me in and this sort of thing. And yet, I think I'm right in saying that she didn't win white women.
It's painful to me, right? Because obviously I want other people to be excited about the first woman president. That said, I can appreciate that people say that may or may not be necessary. It's definitely not sufficient. And that is a liberal viewpoint. I can appreciate that. And while I would have been happy, you had a lot of Republicans who were happy to see Obama win. There was sort of this initial rush to say, okay, well, it's great. We've done this. This is healing. Okay, now let's start fighting him on policy. I think if you had seen somebody like Marco Rubio won, who I disagree with on a bunch of issues, but he has a way of speaking that makes him sound less hostile than some other candidates, in addition to his candidacy potentially being historic. And I think you would have seen maybe some comparable, like, okay, that's good. Good job, guys. We're sad, but okay, that's a good thing for the country that you have, diversity in your ranks, too. At least I feel that way. Maybe not everybody feels that way. But I want to see diversity in both Democrat and Republican candidate fields. But not everybody has that point of view. They say, I want to vote for a woman. I just don't think that she's the right person. Is she unfairly viewed because of her gender? Yes. Is that 100%? Of what happened? No. Is that 0%? No. There was a poll done that asked, and it was just of New Jersey, and it was earlier on in the cycle, and they asked...
My favorite state. So
that's right, mine too, right? Right. Both of us have family there. But I don't know if they were respondents in the survey. But half of the poll that they were asked before the vote question, something about gender roles in your household. And half of the other half of the sample, they got asked that question at the end of the survey. And from white men who were asked about gender roles in the first half of the survey before the vote, they were more likely to vote for Trump than men who were asked about gender roles at the end of the survey. That there was something about being prompted about gender, changing gender roles that made them say, you know what, I'm for Trump. And you didn't see that effect for women at all, not even really on the other side. So there's something going on there. And I don't, you know, we thought that that was going to be the whole story of this election. It turns out there's just so much to talk about on the Trump side that we spent a little bit less time than maybe we had suspected talking about gender. But that is also part of what goes on here. I do think that, you know, and that Clinton had a kind of a damned if she does, damned if she doesn't, you know, point of view when it comes to talking about gender. Obviously, it's good to talk about. Why hide it? And on the other hand, so people don't like having that circled and highlighted, you know, there's bias. And then if people say, well, if I don't vote for her, is it because I'm biased? Maybe I just want to pay lower taxes, which, you know, that's a reasonable position to have. Just because you want to pay lower taxes and you vote Republican doesn't mean that you don't like women candidates. Now, for the people who are kind of foaming at the mouth when they talk about Clinton and lock her up, there's a gendered component to that I find unsettling. In addition to a lot of, and I put it in the same category as a lot of the racially coded stuff. And I think I'll close this point part with saying I do think there could have been more that the Clinton team could have done to offer a positive economic message, to offer something that sounded new to people. And I know that that is tough given that she has this track record. And I also know that it is so easy and clear to make this contrast with Trump. Why not? He's so Trumpy. Why not go contrastive on him? There's so much material there. But I think for a lot of voters, they're like, I know, I get it, but I am going to vote for him anyway. And they wanted to have some other kind of alternative. And without that kind of alternative, then it allowed that who is Hillary Clinton ? To be filled in by, you know, Trump and Trump-aligned media.
And there were lots of events that went against her as well, such as Comey and all sorts of things as well. I mean, let's talk about the polling a bit, given the title of this podcast. Rob, I'll bring you in at this stage. I mean, it's fashionable at the moment to kick the pollsters, understandably, given the last sort of 2 years, as I've mentioned. But how badly wrong did the pollsters get this election? Because, I mean, you had a piece in The Guardian this past week, so talking a bit about that, so I wanted to get some of your perspectives there.
Yeah, I think it's... So the point I made in The Guardian, and I still stand by this, is I think focusing purely on the pollsters is a big part of the problem, which is that the media are very keen to use the polling data when it's serving their purposes of having a horse race story every day, who's up, who's down, who's in and who's out and so on, which, as I think lots of our listeners will know, is not the best way to use polling data. And what you really need to do is look at it as part of the big picture, as it's scoping out the battlefield, making clear what the issues are and, you know, what the sort of contours of the election are, rather than predicting what's actually going to happen. Now, that's not meant to sound like a cop-out. That's meant to be like, look, journalists and pollsters are both in a business of telling stories. And I think what people have got too locked onto is one particular aspect of the story. I mean, lots of the things and issues that Margie was talking about there, of reasons for the victory, were there in the polling data. You know, we knew that turnout amongst African Americans was going to be an issue for Clinton. You know, a key part of Obama's coalition wasn't that enthused about Hillary Clinton. That meant that you needed to do something about that. You know, his victory in 2012 wasn't so overwhelming that a key part of that coalition not being that motivated to vote gave you a free pass, right? So I think lots of, and, you know, similarly Hispanic voters, there was some evidence that, unlike what you might expect given Trump's rhetoric, there were a fair number of Hispanic voters, for whatever reason, and let's remember that in Florida, a key swing state, Hispanic voters are very different to Hispanic voters in other places. You know, there were lots of reasons why they didn't like Hillary Clinton and why they did like, you know, Trump, for whatever reason, whether it's his entrepreneurialism or, you know, whatever religious values or the Supreme Court or whatever else it might be. But I think lots of those things were underwritten because they were quite a challenging narrative and they were kind of counterfactuals which people weren't necessarily that interested in. And then when we go to actually the numbers, we know that the national horse race showed a 2 to 3 point lead on average. It's going to come out at somewhere between a 1 to 2 point lead for Hillary Clinton. That's well within whatever margin of error you want to give it. And then even in the swing states, you know, by election day, there was, like, you know, I think only really Wisconsin was well beyond the margin of error. And I know margin of error people think of as being a get out, but it's there for a reason, right? You know, these are like probability based things. you know, you do the very best you can. And I'm sure in the future there'll be all sorts of stuff written about improving turnout models or improving the way in which we wait for past vote. You know, estimating what turnout's going to be is a notoriously difficult problem, one that you try and do within the same poll, but actually is essentially what you're trying to predict with the poll. You know, all of these things are difficult things, and I think it's easy for pollsters like me to sort of sit here and get out the violins for the pollsters because we're getting a bit of a hard time. But at the same time, like, it's a complex business, and lots of it was right and lots of the evidence was there. You know.
But isn't the real thing though? I mean, you remember on our podcast before the election, you and Leo both saw
really confident
3 or 4 point Clinton lead, but she won, in inverted commas, the popular vote, or she did win the popular vote, by a couple of points. That wasn't actually that far off. I mean, it wasn't the real issue, was the Electoral College, wasn't
it? And as her gap lead increases with the popular vote, in fact, the national polls seem completely right on. It's just the few states that led the whole map, and there are states that are all near each other. So Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, those states, Ohio less so. I think people thought that was going to trend toward Trump. But that group of states in particular, all seemingly to be leaning Clinton in some degree or tied. But when they all went to Trump, that ends up really throwing everybody's map out of whack. And that's one of the ways that it really, you know, that it quickly started to go wrong for her on election night. It's easy to want to, and I guess we're all here as not just pollsters, but as people who comment on polls, and that's part of the issue too. It's not just the polls, it's the commenting on polls. And of course, if, you know, a lot of the aggregators and forecasters, they're not, and even myself and Kristen as folks who have a podcast, you know, we have some of our own polling, but we're not only talking about our own polls, we're talking about all the public polls out there. Same thing with 538, which people refresh all day long, which I find kind of incredible, or the Upshot, or Real Clear Politics, which are all, they're all fabulous. All those folks are great,
and,
right?
And they built in a massive probability of a Trump win compared to everybody else, right? I mean, Princeton had it at like 1%, and he had it at 33%.
But people weren't.
And he does that by minimizing the reliance on the actual polls, you know, by saying, well, this pollster is a little bit more right, or we're going to put, then others, and we're going to put in a little bit about the economy, and he has some other things in the model in order to adjust for the fact that you're not just saying the polls are right, let's put it in a model. And when all the other pollsters, I mean all the other aggregators, just look at the polling numbers, they come up with the numbers that you saw, which is the 98% chance that Clinton's going to win. There is no way you could look at the public polling and say Trump is going to win. It was just how confident you were that Clinton was going to win. And so it's not the fault of the aggregators and the forecasters for saying it looks like Clinton's going to win, because everybody, you know, the only people who said Trump is going to win were looking at something completely different from data. Even the Trump campaign and Republicans on Election Day were indicating that they thought Clinton was going to win. So their internal numbers must not have been.
I found Trump's tone on the morning of the election. I think, I can't remember what the show's called, but he was on Fox News, and that morning show he does
Fox
quite regularly.
And Friends,
And his tone on that interview was very much defeatist. It didn't sound like a man that thought, oh, I've secretly won this. Let's talk about Donald Trump, President-elect Trump, I should say. He's been tweeting the last couple of days, as he's wont to do, talking about, I think his tweet yesterday said, in addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. And there's a series of other tweets he's added to this, including serious voter fraud in Virginia, New Hampshire and California. One can only speculate why he's picked those three states. So why isn't the media reporting on this? Serious bias, big problem. I mean, it seems like he's, after a week or so of being conciliatory, he's sort of back to the old Donald. I mean, what's our sort of take on his transition at the moment? I guess, Rob, I'll ask you that one.
I think
and there's also the recruitment of his cabinet as well that's going on, I suppose, isn't
it? Well, I think on the election, on the recounts and fraud or whatever, I mean, I think it's just one of those things where his sort of media relations policy is, they've got a story that's against me, therefore I'm going to try and change the story to one that's against them. It's quite simple, you know. It's like this, the back and forth of the old campaign.
Just using Twitter this time.
It's like having a dysfunctional member of your family who you're like, you know, they're just constantly trying to change the subject and say something crazy. And at some point you're like, you know, I'm not going to go visit Aunt Betty anymore.
I'm not going to visit President Trump anymore.
But we don't have a choice because he's our president.
But what's surprising about it is, like, we kind of grew to expect this on the campaign trail. Yeah. What's surprising is that he's continuing it now. I mean, I don't know what Margie thinks, but I don't think any serious Democratic operatives think that the result's going to change through any of these recounts or legal challenges or any of these other things. You would expect if the this was the other way round, there's no way that a president-elect Clinton would be responding to, like, claims of...
It could get fascinating in foreign policy. I mean, at the moment, this is very much an internal US thing, which is new and really different to how we're used to president-elects sort of behaving. But when this becomes a sort of international thing, at some point during his presidency, presumably it will.
Well, yeah, and we've already seen that with, like, thinking that Farage would make a great ambassador and, you know, things where I imagine there's people in the State Department already just working out what on earth they're going to do about someone who conducts... diplomacy, in inverted commas, through Twitter.
Well, not even just that. So, I mean, also the conversations he has with, you know, foreign leaders. Can you fix my... And it's all the conflict of interest. Can you fix the zoning issue in wherever it was, Brazil or Argentina? Because I'm having some issues with one of my properties there. Now, that's not going to make any difference for the average voter. I mean, if calling Mexicans rapists, if, you know, sexual assault... and being cavalier about it, if, you know, his debate performances, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need to go through the whole list again. And none of those things mattered. Having a conversation about zoning with a world leader is going to be, you know, 8,000th on that list of things that people find upsetting about Trump. But nonetheless, that's going to have an impact into how people abroad view him and what that means, the international impact of Trump, when people feel that, you know, you have foreign leaders saying, well, I could just lob a call on them and I'm going to, you know, give some kind of benefit to one of his properties and then I'm going to get some kind of other trade deal benefit.
But isn't it the kind of fodder that the Democrats could spend their time behaving like Ken Starr with the Clintons throughout the late 90s? I mean, isn't that the kind of thing that Democrats in the House, if they were to take...
They've got to take it back first, haven't they? But let's talk about the Democrats. I'm conscious of time. It's the last sort of few minutes. Let's talk about where they go from here. A lot of people that like to... So I want to get both of your perspectives on what the Democratic Party does next. I mean, for me, it feels very similar to the Labour Party in 2015, where Labour lost when they maybe... it's different context. Maybe didn't expect to win outright, but thought Ed Miliband might become the next Prime Minister. Then Labour lurches to the left... to use a phrase, in electing Jeremy Corbyn and then subsequently re-electing him. Now, different countries, different process of electing leaders, but I suppose there is a chance, isn't there, Margie, that a similar process could happen. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's going to be some internal struggle, just the way there always is after you lose an election, where it's not so, you know, if you win, then you get to pick all your people. All your, you know, you win, you're triumphant, all your people get... jobs wherever they want, you know, and all the people who agree with you get, you know, some kind of leadership post, right? That's how it works. When you don't win, then it's a little bit unclear what happens next. And so there are a couple different trains of thought, right? One is we need some diversity in the party, diversity in leadership, whether that means someone like Keith Ellison, who's Muslim member of Congress. It could also mean Elise Hogue, a woman who's who heads NARAL, the Abortion Rights Action League. You know, other people who represent some sort of diversity.
And this is for DNC chair.
The DNC chair, right? So that's, and that sort of sets the tone. Sorry, that sets the tone for where the party is headed and what are the priorities of the party. But then you also have the leaders who are elected officials, and those, there's also diversity there too, whether it's Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren, who are folks that people are looking to help provide not just the policy guidance, but the enthusiasm. And remember, that's important too. It's not so much necessarily about the specifics of some, you know, policy here or there. It's who do people get really excited about? And I think that's something that Democrats definitely need to work on, you know, coming together. And both Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker, they have different views on some issues. They have different priorities. They have different strengths and weaknesses, but they both get Democrats excited.
Mm. Are those two candidates that you, I mean, we're not going to call a nominee for 2020 four years out.
It's a little early.
Are those sort of the types of people that watchers from over this side of the pond, Leo hates it when I use that phrase, but he's not here. They should be watching Cory Booker from New Jersey, Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, they are folks who, you know, fill a room, right? They are folks who get people excited. They are folks who, you know, get voters, rank and file voters excited. They represent some diversity. They represent, you know, Cory Booker's young, right? So he may be seen more as sort of the future of the party. Elizabeth Warren, though, she also, is... shares a lot of the same policy views as Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders obviously generated a lot of enthusiasm. So I think people are going to be, you know, trying to figure out what's next for Democrats. The other kind of issue is how we talk about race and ethnicity and how do we appeal to white voters. One theory had been, just like Republicans said, no one's ever going to try this again, a theory had been in Democratic circles, And we just have to wait for the demographics to catch up, right? You're going to have, you know, a more diverse electorate. You're going to have more white professional college-educated women in the workplace. And you take all that together and, you know, and younger folks who are more liberal, and you add all that, and that's going to be a Democratic coalition that that will just emerge, and they will be with us. And if white, downscale, rural men are not with us, we don't need to move our whole party to address them because we'll have this other block, right? That's not, you know, maybe the most, it is as reductive and simplistic of a viewpoint as Republicans saying, oh, we need to talk about immigration in order to move Latino. I mean, sometimes these conversations can sound coarse. But that was one of the viewpoints. And now I think there's going to be some introspection as whether or not really that can continue to be the viewpoint of the Democratic Party, given how easily Trump was able to run up the score with that, with white voters at the expense of, you know, some minority support, even if it was, you know, a little bit better than Romney. Still, you know, it wasn't like he was making real inroads there. You know, that's that he was, you know, his victory came from white voters. So what does that mean for Democrats? Do we have to embrace our diversity and really use that as a counter lever to whatever Trump is offering? Or do we have to find more ways to expand our tent and bring in some more of these white voters, disaffected white voters, and from the, you know, who are going to feel quickly disillusioned by Trump's, I'm using air quotes here, policies.
Final word of this half of the show to Rob, I guess. I mean, what's your take on some of these issues? The comparison is always made, in Britain it is at least, between what's going on with the Labour Party here, what's going on with the Democrats in America. And yes, let's leave to one side. We obviously know that a very different country is different processes and all the rest of it. But who do you see as kind of the future leadership of the Democrats, maybe even a nominee in 2020? How do you see some of these issues playing out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the names that Margie mentioned are obviously right. I think Castro.
Bernie Sanders? Or was his day gone?
I mean, I'm not sure you get to have a second crack at the whip, and I'm not sure that anybody really buys the idea that Sanders would have. I think the argument that Sanders would have got a different result than Clinton is a hard one to make, and I don't think it's necessary to sort of relitigate that here. But I think
a lot of Democrats voted for him to be a nominee, though, right?
I mean, sure. No. I suppose my point is, like, I think you need to do something in addition, and that means someone new and a bit different. And whoever that is, I think, you know, the names mentioned and Castro, there's others who I think stand the chance of being that fresh face. But I mean, let's remember, nobody, as far as I'm aware, in 1988 thought that Bill Clinton was going to be the nominee. And so it's like that classic thing of the party needs to have that period. The biggest difference in the system.
Yeah, people didn't think Obama. I mean, no, it was of course, a surprise,
yeah.
Right?
But I mean, the biggest difference in systems is that America, the Democratic Party, essentially has 3 years to have that conversation, to have that introspection, to work out, to have loads of fundraisers, to have loads of meetings between different governors of different bits and all the rest of it before you end up going to the, in a sense, the public and making the pitch. In Britain, it all happened within about 6 weeks.
Because we haven't, in our discussions of potential names for the future, we haven't actually mentioned any governors, have we? They're all senators. And
well, part of the challenge is that there aren't that many, right? I mean, so relatively speaking. So, I mean, the first task for the, in many ways, the Democratic Party is to work out how it takes back some more of those governor's houses and state legislatures and so on, so that when the redistricting, you know, the whole sort of long, hard slog of being essentially at the bottom of the thing here with Republican unified control of all three, you know, it's a long, hard slog back to get to power.
It's true. And I'll just add one little bit to what Rob said, right? It's not just, you know, an election can change at all, which it certainly can, but you have to wait till redistricting in the House, which hasn't happened for another few years. That is dependent on what goes on in the state chambers, as Rob was saying. And so that is, there are a lot of hurdles there to overcome, a lot of very conservative chambers in a lot of states, and they're not going to develop maps that are going to be warm and hospitable to Democrats. You add on top of that a 2008 map for the Senate that is not favorable to Democrats, and you add on top of all that the natural demographic sorting that happens in our country that we can't blame on anybody. That's just how it is, where you have liberals moving to cities and leaving Republicans, you know, in some of the interior rural areas. And as that happens, it just becomes the nature and logistics of separating out those districts into ways that, you know, are easy to do. That becomes harder too.
Well, that's all we've got time for part one, Margie. I know you're rushed for time, so thank you so much for joining us in person.
Really great.
And for those of you who are not familiar with the pollsters, maybe you want to give a quick plug to the pollsters.
Yes. So it's bipartisan. Myself and Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson, we do a show every week, and we do not just politics and political polling, but also some of the fun stuff like the latest data on your favorite Prince song or pumpkin spice latte. I don't know if that's a big thing here, but it's a very big thing in the States in the at Christmas time and winter. So we have, there's polling on
that.
We're
more mulled wine and mulled cider and mulled alcohol.
Exactly. Right. Well, we like our sweet coffee, like dessert at all times. So, you know, so we have data on all that stuff. You know, best drivers, favorite candy, that kind of thing. So, and we're every week, you can find us anywhere, including Spotify. And we'll have some big news about a new announcement from the pollsters probably within the next week or so.
Excellent. I know a lot of people that listen to the show, this podcast, do listen to the pollsters as well, because they've told me they do. But if you don't, do check it out. And that's all we've got time for part one. But Rob and I will be back in a moment talking about events in the UK today, where UKIP, of course, has a new leader. That was Margie O'Meara from the pollsters, and do check out that podcast. It's if you're a US political junkie, as I suspect some of you might be, then you'll really enjoy that. So do check it out if you haven't already. So for part two, it's going to be a brief conversation between me and Rob talking about today's events in Westminster, where Paul Nuttall has been elected as leader of UKIP with 62% of the votes cast for him. He'll be looking to try and unite the party, which I think to say is could win awards for its sort of vitriol and fractious nature, even, you know, given that the Labour Party are in the UK, UKIP's been giving them a run for their money in terms of division. And he's also got a really difficult strategic decision to make about where UKIP goes from here, having seemingly achieved everything the party wanted to in the Brexit vote last June. Some people question, what's the point in UKIP now? And with Nigel Farage leaving, very big shoes to fill, whether you like those shoes or not, it's fair to say that the new leader has a lot to contend with. So Rob, I mean, what's your reaction to events today? Perhaps not very surprising that he won, but now the tough task comes of actually where he takes UKIP from here.
I think it was surprising, the sort of the scale of his victory, actually. I think it was pretty convincing on what was actually an interestingly a low turnout or lower turnout poll than had been the case whenever it was that, you know, in September when the last leadership result was.
Seems so long ago now.
I know, so much water under the bridge since then. But I think it's really interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that it is a perfect strategic play to take potentially some northern working class Labour, as were inverted commas, heartland seats into play. I think he's an interesting voice from that perspective. He comes from a wing of the party that wouldn't naturally be, I think, Farage's. I think it's interesting that Farage today gave him somewhat conditional support, saying that he was something like the right leader at this time, or words to that effect, which is a fairly, not exactly a ringing endorsement, I think it's fair to say. And that's quite telling, because I think you say that Farage looms, I mean, he really does loom in the background. We've seen over the last couple of weeks, you know, he's making the most out of his relationship with Trump. Who knows exactly how close that really is, but he's certainly doing a lot to further that. Whether that's because he wants his own like TV show in the States or here, or whether that's because actually he just wants to pivot back to but you know, like there's a question mark over what Farage's future is. Certainly he doesn't want to be the leader at this moment in time, but even the fact that everybody cares what he thinks makes it feel like, you know, he's certainly not out of the picture. That to me is the greatest strategic opportunity, because Paul Nuttall comes across as a fairly working class scouser who sort of tells it how it is, but isn't the sort of wind up of the, as it were, the liberal metropolitan whatever it is that Farage is. Speaks to a slightly different audience, sounds quite credible on lots of the kind of what you might describe as bread and butter issues. He's not one to go out there and just, you know, wind up the media in the way that Farage would do, and Trump, we've seen, very effectively do. Speaks quite directly to people's concerns. And that, I think, is a real threat for the Labour Party. It's an opportunity to pivot UKIP from being, as he said in his opening speech, the party that wants a referendum on the membership of the European Union, to being the voice of English nationalism. And that's a very, very dangerous place for the conversation to shift for lots of Labour.
And I think he targeted Jeremy Corbyn directly today. I haven't got the speech in front of me, but he talked about how UKIP isn't going to talk about Castro and climate change. It's going to talk about sort of real issues facing working class people. And that word working class kept coming up time and time again, which I thought was interesting, that it's not a word, I don't think that's a phrase you hear a lot of, even though actually, if you look at some data from NatSem, and other sort of organisations, quite a lot more people consider themselves working class in this country than maybe would be defined as that by some of the traditional ways of defining
people. It's a really, it's sort of, there's all sorts of things in there. Like, cephalogically, it's really interesting. UKIP's in a situation where it's not trying to be, as it were, a majoritarian party that wins the majority of seats in Parliament, which is what the Labour Party has been for over a century. What it wants to do is essentially what, you know, the Labour Party was trying to do in the sort of the late 19th century and early 20th century, which is to supplant the Liberals as the second part, as the second party of in the country. And to do that, actually, you can run a strategy which is effectively like, as Paul Nuttall, Nigel Farage is still there, and for the voters that want Nigel Farage and the brand of UKIP that Nigel Farage represents, that remains there. Paul Nuttall is going to speak to, yeah, as you say, a disaffected working class in northern towns and cities that were devastated by Thatcherism, and, you know, feel that they are never going, they would never, or be very, very unlikely to vote Conservative, but they might well be, to an extent, fed up with whatever you want to badger as the establishment or Labour, or what, you know, the two things being the same thing in lots of voters, in some voters' minds.
One thing I wonder, which I think feels credible, is that an unintended consequence of this could be that proportional representation and electoral reform is back on the political agenda. Maybe not immediately, but in the near future. Because one of the things Paul Nuttall mentioned was that UKIP got 4 million votes, or thereabouts. I think it was slightly less at the last general election. But 4 million is the phrase people, or the word people use. But they got one seat, as we all know. Mm. And Nigel Farage failed to enter Parliament. So I wonder whether UKIP might be pushing that line quite heavily to try and again win over ex-Labour voters, on the basis that, not on the basis of PR, but on the basis that the system is rigged.
Well, I'd be surprised. I think one of the interesting things and the interesting phenomena of UKIP was that they were always very much in favour of first past the post, and as far as I'm aware, never articulated a desire to change the electoral system, which is interesting because third parties or fourth parties, as was the case for a long time, you know, always would. You know, that was like a key plank of everything.
They called first past the post out of date or something.
That is interesting, and I suppose one could argue that that actually is an expression of a lack of confidence. You know, one of the, you know, if they really believed that they were going to supplant, you know, the Lib Dems as in Parliament the third party, or actually SNP, but anyway, you know, if they really thought that they were going to become like, you know, the third party in England, then, and if they really felt that they were going to displace Labour in, you know, lots of northern seats, then, you know, that would imply that they would, you know, wouldn't be in favour of AV. If they are wanting AV or PR or some similar thing, then I find that quite surprising, and it feels like to me a bit of a concession of, you know, what is in fairness a big, big uphill challenge for them. I mean, I know that there was some stats going around earlier, but, you know, he stood in Bootle, I think, which is his home constituency, three times, and each time he's gone up in the vote, but it's still only at sort of 11-12% or something. That does show you the kind of scale of the challenge. We know a couple of years ago, there was the by-election in Heywood and Middleton, I think it was, where actually, you know, where, you know, they didn't, you know, hit the numbers that they were expecting to or wanting to hit. There was the other by-election just after the defeat in 2015, after Michael Meach's death, where again they didn't win that seat. So I mean, there is a real challenge for them in terms of actually supplanting Labour in those regions. We should not in any way take it for granted.
What's Labour's response? Because it does feel like Labour ideologically being pulled in all sorts of different directions. There's this traditional macro thing around, you know, who's the most credible Prime Minister, Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn, who's most credible on the economy. We always bang on about that on this podcast, the more traditional horse race between Labour and the Conservatives. But then there's also this dynamic of, does Labour aim to speak for the 48% that voted Remain? But then, of course, if it does that, it's only ever going to be further and further away from the very people that you're talking about up north, that Paul Nuttall will be targeting. You know, these northern Labour voters that voted Leave presumably would be people that he has to target. So how does Labour respond? I guess I've sort of talked my way through that sentence into thinking, well, it's got to pick a course and stick to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me is in a sense the ray of hope, actually, in this as a sort of card-carrying Labour supporter, which is the one thing that I think Corbyn kind of has going for him is that, by and large, people might not agree with him necessarily, but there's an extent to which people think of him as being authentic. And I think the danger in all of this is that he ties himself in knots. I mean, it's why I don't agree with him and what he said over the weekend about Castro and so on. I don't think it's particularly politically helpful. But I also kind of think that's what he thinks. Mm. And to that extent,
well, he would have lost credibility if he started talking about something else, precisely.
Right? So, to that extent, I think the way in which you have to sort of come at all of these questions, whether it's Brexit, whether it's, you know, the leadership of the country and the direction that the country's going to take, whether it's how you respond to UKIP specifically, or, you know, and I think doing it in an authentic way and articulating what the Labour values are. But most importantly, I think the biggest lesson over the last, if you like, 6 months from sort of both sides of the Atlantic is it needs to really genuinely listen. And we've talked, I mean, it's bizarre that we're sort of back to this thing. And I'm not talking about sort of Blairite-like big conversation type thing. But genuinely listening. I mean, you know, there are people in communities which have voted Labour for a long, long time. There is clearly some discontent with the way in which they perceive the party to be going. People need to be listening to that. People need to be listening to that. And I think the debate over the direction of the party is far too, if you like, focused, and it's much easier for it to focus in the way in which the media cover it and all the rest of it, as a battle over sort of individuals, as if, like, suddenly by supplanting Jeremy Corbyn as leader, the sort of party's issues will all be over for a bunch of MPs over here. That's not the case. Those MPs are very, very conscious of speaking to the voters. They think that Jeremy Corbyn isn't part of the solution. Fine. The party has decided he's the leader. What they need to be doing is getting out there and articulating why their Labour values are best placed to respond to what their constituents and potential constituents are thinking about where the country's going. And I think the fact is that we've not seen much, as it were, remorse over the Brexit decision. Therefore, the party needs to be thinking, OK, so how do we make a success of this? So being the party of the 48%, I think, is probably a bit of a blind alley, because not least the overlap between Labour voters and voting for Brexit, not least the geography of where, you know, the Brexit votes were and the threat of UKIP and so on. But also, it feels like you're not listening to people. You know, if you come out and say we're going to have whatever it is, you know, they've avoided saying a second referendum. I think that's right. I think you've got to sort of say we're going to make a success of this. And then that demonstrates that you're listening, and then work out a way of pivoting to, and we're going to make it a success in this way. This is what we would do differently.
I suppose the final point to talk about this week is the Richmond by-election, which is on Thursday. There was some briefing, as there would be in the absence of any polling. The Liberal Democrats are catching up locally, although...
Private poll released.
Private poll, Claxon, you know, always a little bit sceptical about that. I mean, we were talking a minute ago, it reminded me about this being...
Was there a bar chart as well?
There may have been a bar chart. I don't know how good the scale was. We'll have to confirm that off air. But the Liberal Democrats, on the most latest YouGov poll, insofar as we care about horse race polling these days, has them on 9 points. And I don't say that to sort of use that as gospel, that they are on 9 points. We all know that the horse race called the last general election incorrectly. But it doesn't seem to be, even within that sort of relative balance of power between the parties, any sense of a Lib Dem surge, nationally at least, as a consequence of being that sort of pro-Remain last bastion, if you like. Yeah. At the same time, in local elections, in local sort of by-elections, which are obviously hodgepodge in terms of where they are, they do seem to be doing reasonably well, taking seats, gaining vote share. So, I mean, what are the Lib Dems looking for on Thursday? Presumably, if they take the seat, that's going to be a really big fillip for them.
It would be a massive fillip for them, because it would be winning back a seat that not that they lost in 2015, but that they lost in 2010. Right? I think Susan Cramer, lost the seat. That would be a big fillip for them. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm guessing it will all be about the momentum. So have they improved their vote share in that seat on last time? I think it would be a big disaster for them if they don't improve on it significantly, because Zach Goldsmith sits in the centre of all of their arguments, really. He ran quite a controversial campaign to be Mayor of London. He was pro-Brexit when his constituency, I believe, or certainly areas around his constituency, wasn't. He said he would do Heathrow. He then has failed to do that and is now standing on a pledge to stop Heathrow, when he'll have even less ability to do that as an independent MP than someone taking the Tory whip. All that aside, they still can't beat him. I mean, maybe he does have a huge personal vote, but that would be surprising. It would be a very weak argument to make that they've not been able to make any ground up on that. But as you say, lots and lots of local sort of what's it called, you know, green shoots, and of course the thing with the Lib Dems particularly is it's a very, very localised vote, and so whilst it might be 9% nationwide, If it's, you know, in the southwest, in southwest London, in other parts of the country, in those market towns and so on, where they still hold out quite a strong presence, the Lewises, the Harrogates, the, you know, other places like that, potentially some university seats and so on, then actually you can imagine it's much easier for the Liberal Democrats to pivot round to being the party of the 48%. They don't need much of that 48%.
Not they'll get it.
No, but they don't need very much of that 48% concentrated as it is in the market towns and university seats of to be able to actually, take a not insignificant number of seats, primarily off the Conservative Party, but also in some places, you know, Labour.
Well, no, that's right, and certainly lots to talk about in the coming weeks as we sort of look back on the incredible year that's been 2016. Well, that's all we've got time for this week's PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. Big thanks to Margie O'Meara again for her insights on the US race. I'm sure we'll be unpicking some of that as we approach the inauguration of President Trump. Thanks, as ever, to Rob Vance for his insight and support. And we'll be back next week with another episode on events closer to home. Hello everyone, it's Kieran again here, just tacking on an extra couple of minutes to this week's podcast in light of the new ICM poll, which has just come out as I was prepared to hit publish on this week's show. So we have a new ICM poll that I thought I'd talk about, and just some of the cross breaks which I thought were worth looking at. So we've got a new ICM poll: Conservatives 44, Labour 28, UKIP 12, Lib Dems 7, Greens 4. So that's a Conservative lead of 16 points. Which is up 2 from earlier on in the month, which I believe was when ICM published their latest poll. So not really a lot of movement, certainly no movement of any real note. There's a point here and there for each of the main parties, but a very solid lead for the Conservatives. But given what Rob and I were just discussing about the potential threat to Labour from UKIP, I thought it'd be worth looking at some of the crossbreaks to see what's going on. Now, we should be very careful about extrapolating too much from crossbreaks, given that the sample sizes are lower and therefore the kind of sample noise and variation can have a big impact. So we shouldn't take any of these numbers to the bank, but they can be directional. They can sort of tell us a bit about what the underlying drivers of the overall numbers are, and also actually, do you know what, whether we might trust them as well, because if we think that there are underlying numbers that don't feel right, then we can maybe query whether the Conservative lead is as big as or will end up being as big as we currently see it being. So just to call out some of the cross breaks, there are some traditionally worrying ones, as you might expect for the Labour Party, given the 16-point lead for the Conservatives. So if we look at the 65 and overs, the Conservatives on 60 points versus Labour's 18, so a 42-point lead. That is astonishing when you consider the variation in turnout that we usually see by age. If we look at social class, something that everyone is talking about at the moment, we're yet to see a so-called white working class crossbreak. I did wonder whether we might see that this week, but perhaps not. But we do see the Tories leading across every social class in a way that you might expect. So 20 points ahead amongst the ABs, but only a point ahead, a statistically insignificant point ahead amongst Ds. But, you know, winning across the board, really, but the lower down the social grade you go, the better Labour do, basically, which is as you might currently expect. But then on this kind of UKIP threat to Labour, there's a couple of crossbreaks that are worth looking at. And again, we should be very careful about it. But it's still worth, I would recommend poll watchers to keep an eye on this. So if we look at the Labour 2015 vote, a sample size of 437, we see 82% of it staying with the Labour Party. So almost one in five going elsewhere. Now, the optimist in the Labour ranks would say, oh, OK, well, maybe there's some votes that can come home to Labour as we get closer to a general election. But I'll leave other people to judge whether they think that's right or not. But we see 9%, almost 1 in 10 of Labour voters from 2015 going to the Conservative Party, but only 2% with this ICM poll going to UKIP. So maybe with all this talk about UKIP taking votes off Labour and, you know, up north and so on and so forth, maybe we're ignoring the real threat to Labour, which is and always will be the Conservatives, notwithstanding the important sort of battle that UKIP and Labour may have over certain working class votes in Labour's northern heartland. We probably should still understand that the overwhelming battle remains between the Conservatives and Labour, despite all the changes in our politics. In fact, in this poll, if we take the 44% that vote Conservative and 28% that say they'll vote Labour, we've actually got 72% of voters voting for two of the main parties, so that's just worth bearing in mind. And if we look at another crossbreak, which is the North, we see that the Conservatives are 10 points ahead of Labour and UKIP on 9 points, which is, you know, pretty solid, and certainly lots of votes there if that was to come to pass at a general election. But maybe this whole idea of, you know, UKIP being the biggest concern of Labour's in the North is a bit overdone. Having said that, if you look at the Midlands, UKIP is on 16% there. So, you know, doing better in the Midlands than in the North for UKIP there. But look, it is only cross breaks, small sample sizes. The sample size in the North there is 503 and the Midlands 471. So I really don't want people to run away with those numbers too much. It's a real pet peeve of mine when you see people, you know, extrapolating Welsh or Scottish voting intention from a UK nationwide poll, for example. But I still think that you can follow them qualitatively, and you can sort of keep an eye on them over time to see what's going on. And it's just something that struck me, actually, that yes, okay, we all know that Labour's poll rating is very bad. We've done that to death on this podcast. But maybe what people are ignoring is that when all is said and done, not ignoring the threat UKIP pose to Labour up North, actually, it's the Conservative Party that may well be the biggest threat, nationwide, of course, but it may be up North and in the Midlands, certainly in the Midlands as well. Now, you know, the more optimistic Labour person would say, OK, you know, there's 1 in 5 Labour votes from 2015 to get back. And do we really believe the Conservatives would win the North by 10 points over Labour? Perhaps not in a general election, you know, so... Yeah, if Labour people want to sort of look at this poll and say, well, actually, it's exaggerating the Conservatives' lead, then maybe some of those numbers are so striking that they're just possibly just not right. So that's something that, you know, we will find out, I guess, in due course. But that's just a quick note from me, just on this ICM poll that's come out. Do check it out in The Guardian. But I thought I'd comment on it just because I was about to hit play and I know that it's going to be landing this afternoon. So I wanted to give my thoughts on that. But once again, thank you all for listening to the show. Hopefully not too much of a mishmash. If you like what you hear, do subscribe on iTunes or Android. Do share the podcast wherever you can. It really does help us get our voice out there. And yeah, do like the Facebook page as well. Lots of places to find us, and we do appreciate you listening, so stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks.